Good afternoon. Welcome to We the People Radio. Another exciting episode. You're going to learn a lot today, actually.
I need to learn a lot today.
Yeah, you do.
Hey, am I on? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I can't hear me.
Get those beans out of your ears.
No.
I can hear Jackson Brown. Oh, there you go.
Whoa.
So today we're chatting with Jim Beers. What? Turn your sound down.
How's
that?
Oh, no.
First he can't hear, now he hears too much. Bill's got a lot of needs.
Man.
You know, if I was listening to this program, I'd say, why don't they take care of this before they start?
This doesn't bode well for Bill.
No, it doesn't bode well for Bill.
Wow.
All righty. So you can find all of our information and a link to the chat room and all that good stuff at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I'm Bob Martin.
I'm already learning stuff.
Knucklehead. We missed you last week, Bob.
I missed you, too. Thanks.
Yeah. It was odd. It was like it busted up the team. we have such a routine. That's the danger with routine. All righty. So let's see. We air on the West Coast here in Redding, California, live from noon to 2 Pacific time, obviously, every Sunday afternoon. And then we air on Saturdays through the Conservative Commandos Radio Network on WNJC 1360 out of Philadelphia and New Jersey. And that is on Saturdays from 2:30 till 4 Eastern time. And that is a recording of the program with all the commercials taken out, which is interesting.
Okay, I don't know if it was just yesterday or if this is from now on, but for whatever reason, yesterday we were on from 3:30 to 5 Eastern time.
Okay, so forget it. I don't know when we're on the East Coast. I don't live on the East Coast anymore, so I guess
roll
I'm not.
Roll that all back.
So you can, on the front page of our website, there's a phone number, actually. It's really handy.
Yeah, call before you listen.
No, you can listen to the show on the phone.
Oh,
and you can listen
to
their other programming. They have, I don't know how many conservative shows, but a bunch. A guy back there just got sick of being sandwiched between a bunch of liberal banter, and so he decided to go to the station and buy up a bunch of airtime and then contact people around the country and see if they would air their shows out there so he could have conservative programming all out, you know, for the full afternoon. I think it's from like noon till 7 every day, Monday through Friday, on that channel. And then, you know, he replays different things at different times when he has holes to fill. But he set up a telephone number. So if you have folks that can't catch the show here because they're outside the listening area and they don't have a computer maybe or they don't have enough bandwidth, they can listen on the phone. The number's 832-999-1199. And you don't have to do anything. No secret password. Doesn't cost you any money if you have free long distance or something like that. And you can just listen to conservative programs.
Yeah. And then you can also, I don't know if you mentioned, you can listen online live through the website. So if you got somebody out of town that wants to listen to the show or wants to learn something, give them the website, let them listen in.
Absolutely. And you can send them a copy of the archive of the show later on. So
there you are.
That is all the news that's fit to print. There you go. That's it.
Yep.
So our guest today is Jim Beers. He is a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wildlife biologist, a special agent, a refuge manager, wetlands biologist, and congressional fellow. He's got quite the resume, too. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's pretty darn great. He was stationed in North Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, New York City, and Washington, D.C., just in case you need variety. He has a bachelor's degree in wildlife resources from Utah State and a master's in public administration from the University of Northern Colorado. He served as a U.S. Navy line officer in the Western Pacific and also in the Aleutian Islands. He's worked for the Utah Fish and Game, Minneapolis Police Department, and as a security supervisor in Washington, D.C. Jim has testified 3 times before Congress, and I thought everybody would like these because initially they're thinking, what? These are the guys we fight all the time. These are the guys we fight all the time. No, he testified twice regarding the theft by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services of $45 to $60 million from the state Fish and Wildlife Funds, and one other time in opposition to expanding federal invasive species authority. He resides in Eagan, Minnesota with his wife of many decades, it says here, so I don't know how long. Long time.
Decades.
So pretty darn great. His email is jimbeers7@comcast.net for those of you that are just not watching the website. If you ever want to shoot him an email, he's a great guest. I'd have him be your speaker if you have a big event coming up and it covers this kind of topic. I posted his talk he gave in Spokane, Washington, to the Citizens Alliance for Property Rights. That was just April 22nd of this year. So he's out and about and by no means really retired. But I thought you probably planned on being retired, huh, Jim?
Yeah, I did eventually, that's for sure.
and then all the agency interaction you had before, they all went crazy, and now we need guys like you to come unravel it for us.
Well, I hope I can help doing that, because that's what I really consider to be important, trying to explain what's going on so people can make good decisions.
Yeah, it's a mess. We've had you on. We had you on a number of, it was like a number of years ago, regarding the wolf issue. It was December 2012, believe it or not. It was kind of a while back. But there's just so much has happened since then. We don't want to just focus on that, obviously. So we'll just go wherever you think it's important to share with folks.
Well, I think what spurred your invite to me this time and brought me to your attention is something that we can carry a little further, because I've done even more research on it to talk about it. But it was about a month ago that I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and there was an editorial in there by a National Park Service former employee that suggested that the Park Service has got an enormous backlog of maintenance. And one article that I've found recently since then claims it to be as much as $11 billion. And this fellow recommended in the Wall Street Journal that the National Park Service stop it acquiring land, sell off some land, and generate revenue for maintenance backlogs, and keeping the Park Service revenues locally and turning to the private economy to tackle infrastructure and operations problems. And in reading that, one of my iterations of my former life with the government was I spent about 5 years as the chief of refuge operations in Washington, which is the guy that was responsible for putting together the budget requests and overseeing the maintenance and the operation funding and support for all of the refuges. So I knew a little bit about what this guy was talking about in the Park Service. And I wrote him and the Wall Street Journal a very short letter saying that this sounds good what you're talking about to get more money. But the problem really isn't that you've got this backlog, you can sell off some land. The problem is that you've overcommitted the whole National Park Service system, just like the Forest Service system and the refuge system and Fish and Wildlife, to a bunch of things and a bunch of land management that you could never, ever have hoped to begin to keep up with in the first place. But nobody's been held accountable for that. And if you go to sell off some of the land and restrict the amount of visitations in that on some of these parks, as he was suggesting, I said you're going to run into one big roadblock, which is that all of these national parks and national wildlife refuges, especially the big ones with high visitor use, have concessions on them, concessionaires, people, private businesses with government contracts, most of whom have been there for many, many years. And over the course of the years, there hasn't been much change in who's the concessionaire at these parks. And those concessionaires come to think of it as they're almost their park. And they have made a lot of improvements. We call them facilities, things like that, putting in sewage systems, roads, putting in blacktopping on parking lots, building additions and that. And those things are all still their property. And when they rehab a restroom or repair a building even, the cost is due back to them, but the parks, the refuges, and the Forest Service, for the most part, don't pay them when they do that because it improves their concessionaire things. But if you were to say, I'm going to sell off this land here and there's not going to be as many visitors coming in, we don't need a concessionaire anymore, you would have to pay off these concessionaires for all of what they've done over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Well, Jim, I don't want to interrupt you, but this sounds like, you know, in my past experience, the concessionaires, isn't that an open bid situation where people can come in and bid for those concessions and that's how they get them? Now, if they make all these improvements, doesn't that kind of lock them in and lock everybody out of the process?
That's exactly what happens. That's exactly what happens. In larger parks, it's usually even larger companies that get a real arm lock on the contracts and staying there. And they become sort of joined at the hip with the superintendents and the regional directors that are over those parks and refuges and national forests.
So they don't come up for a bid every year
or
every
five?
Or if they do, they probably have a clause in there where they can
they get
pick
first.
Whoever they want, regardless of
exactly.
what the bid is. And
that's fantastic.
It's the good old boy thing.
Hey, fellas, before we get too far behind here, we need to take a really quick break. And then we will jump right back in.
God, I got some questions.
I know. I knew you were going to like this.
This is starting to stink.
I told Bill he was going to like this. We are chatting with Jim Beers on, I think I pirated the title of the article I read. It was called Lost in the Wilds of Neglect. And I thought that was such a good name, so we stole it for the show. We'll be right back with Jim. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That's what they tell us.
Yeah, unless you're at the Burger Shack at the National Forest concession.
Hey, okay, so, Bill, you had a question.
Well, Jim was talking about how the concession thing is working at these national parks and how they can make their improvements to the little area that's actually their property, which locks them in pretty much to next year or, you know, if they're a five-year concession or whatever. Forest Service isn't going to be too inclined to have them take all their stuff out, so who's going to get
the... They've got to pay for it.
Yeah, who's going to get the renewal on that? So it kind of turns into kind of a family business at some point, doesn't it, Jim?
It does. And in looking into this, for this very radio program, I found some very, very disturbing things out from current and past accountants that have dealt with this problem and government accountability in the last 15 years since I was forced to retire. And I'd like to kind of quickly share some of those with you because I think you'll find it very interesting. First of all, I was asking these fellows singly, but I've known them for years, what about audits of these concessions? Where could I get a copy of the audit about the amount of money? And they laughed, both of them. They don't do those anymore. They said that back in the early 2000, they changed the General Accounting Office in Washington from the General Accounting Office to the General Accountability Office. And it was no longer an organization of professional accountants, certified public accountants that in fact conduct and report on audits. It's now a group of liberal arts majors and that who go to various places occasionally and do accountability reports, which is just sort of like
that's
a
wildly different.
What?
Yeah, that's wildly different.
Well, now, what do you mean by accountability reports? What are they looking for?
It can be whatever you imagine. That's exactly what they told me. They said there's no dollar amounts of dollar flow reporting. They said that loss of audit reporting within the federal government is matched by the fact that the inspector generals in each department have really turned into a really crooked bunch that no longer audits the department that they're located in as an independent auditor. That was their function. They're now just part of the power structure and they are used to justify whatever the agencies and the department want done.
Well, I learned about that kind of the hard way with the VA. We knew that the benefits office down in Oakland was up to no good. So the VA inspector general goes in there, and then, surprise, the report goes to the agency, and they get as much, I mean, I don't know if the time was unlimited, but they got a lot of time to see the whole report, confer with the inspector general, decide what they wanted in the report, and then it went to Congress after that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We could never see the draft report. So we could never see what they originally found before
So it ends up being a shining review on how good a job they're
doing. So it winds up being they just need more oversight and probably a bigger budget. It's like, oh.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the IG is no longer a watchdog.
No.
An IG is just another one of the staff, reporting on themselves is what it amounts to.
Sure. And so while people are always
asking
worried
about these concessions, both of these guys told me that probably as of 15 years ago in the there was over $1 billion of these concession payback things, like a balloon payment or not amortized item, say whatever you want to about it. It's a golden parachute, if you will, for these concessionaires if they ever decide to call them in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, now, but then we can't really verify that because there's no
accounting office.
Audit reports. And in fact, he told one of them told me that the federal government has tried very hard and has been successful at getting the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants to adopt the same standards as accounting in Europe, which he said is there are no restrictions about who's an accountant and what's accounting and what are the requirements of an audit report.
Wow.
So they're coming at it from both angles here, perverting the inspector generals and the public accountants, and the general accounting office too, into sort of there's no real accountability or no real numbers available, so the first liars got all of the advantage. If the government goes into a hearing and says, "Well, we've only got this out of the other thing," you don't have any way to refute it. In fact, one of these fellows was in the Department of Justice not very long ago, and while he was there, the State Department called over and said they needed $100 million by noon. And lo and behold, he said this government employee that he was working with went over on the computer and did some magic work and came up and called him back and said that he just transferred $100 million to him. And when he hung up, this fellow told me that he asked me, he said, where did you get that kind of money here to send over to a different department? And he said, he said it's money that we haven't spent for 10 or 15 years, and he said we keep it in certain accounts and we just pull it out.
Oh, nice.
God. No, okay. But think about that
in terms of
50% of the taxpayers
of the
just fainted.
And all of that. And the Department of Justice, do you remember when Obama first came in, a year or two in, he bought a prison in Illinois? And that prison had been built by the state of Illinois, a pretty high security prison. But they didn't have the money to open it and operate it. Big surprise, they're going broke there. And all of a sudden, the federal government, out of nowhere, bought it. And there was no inkling in the budget of Congress authorizing it or giving them the money for it. And this one auditor that I was talking to confirmed what I had been told a couple years ago, that, in fact, the Department of Justice bought the entire prison overnight with money from the seized property funds that they get from arrests. You remember back in the late 80s, and there was a lot of drug problems, and then there was going to be a lot more prison for these guys and drug offenders, and they were going to clean it up. And they passed laws that said that the government could seize any property attached to the arrest or the transportation. So the government was seizing yachts and seizing buildings and seizing vehicles, and some of the vehicles would be used by other law enforcement agencies. A lot of the stuff would be auctioned off. Estates would be auctioned off, the whole nine yards. And they had enough money sitting in the Department of Justice to just buy a prison right off the top of their head with none of the 200 and some years of checks and balances that we all think the federal government has to operate under.
Well, those seizure laws have been in full force, at least in California, for many, many years, and it finances law enforcement agencies throughout the state. And there's always been
a little
controversy over, what what property is legally taken under those laws, because I guess the way it's written is any property gotten by illegal means or of raising money through drug sales or whatever is they can confiscate and sell at auction.
And it's before the person goes through the judicial process.
Yeah, there's no judicial process in the meantime.
See, the thing that I'm trying to bring up here in this discussion is that once they have it, how they use it and where it goes.
Somebody needs to
account
for that.
There's no documentation. There's no real audit that says this much is on hand now, this much was used for this, this much was used for that.
So much for the appropriations process.
Exactly. And, I mean, the appropriations process has been set up like this for years. Back in 1984, you know, these excise taxes that you mentioned that I testified before Congress that the Fish and Wildlife Service stole from back in the 1990s to put wolves in, the $45 to $60 million. Well, those funds back in 1984 were revised by Congress to allow Louisiana to take $150 million a year off the top of the fishery excise taxes that are supposed to go to state fish and wildlife agencies and give the money to the Army Corps of Engineers, who passes it through to the state of Louisiana. And the justification for that $150 million a year to Louisiana was that Louisiana was subsiding into the Gulf of Mexico and losing X million acres a year or something of wetlands, and this was money to kind of supplement that. Well, you know, one of the fellows I was talking to used to handle that, and he said that money is still being passed through every year, $150 million. Army Corps of Engineers take a nick out of it for administering this, gives the money in a block, the state of Louisiana, and that money disappears into the government of Louisiana.
General fund.
And there's never even been a bulldozer started with that money. There's
wow.
nothing. It's not used for anything other than pass-through money. And it was called the Wallop-Breaux Act that authorized that. Breaux was the senator from Louisiana then, you know, and he got a lot of people liked him and whatever. But again, the accounting and the reporting on this stuff is just getting lost.
So,
I don't know where.
So, Jim, on getting back to the concession thing is, can you kind of give us an overview of how that process is supposed to work?
Except we have to take a really quick break.
Okay, maybe
we didn't
come
see
back.
Bob give us the high sign.
How that process is supposed to work to allow people to bid for it or whatever. I'm kind of curious on how it's been skewed.
Yeah, but I'm making a list of all the things I want to know. All right, we're going to come right back.
My head's exploding.
You can't have your head explode. We're only a half hour in. We're here with Jim Beers. He's a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wildlife biologist, special agent, refuge manager, and wetlands biologist. He's also a congressional fellow, so he's got all sorts of great information. We will be back with him in just a minute. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
My life was oh so simple. and the ways of the great world seem strange and funny. Then when I was a young man, I learned of that machine. It turns out all those bales of precious money.
Song they play at all their staff parties.
It's what they play when you win the concession at the state park. There's a dance that goes with it.
Please do it for us.
Here we go.
Oh, funny. So we're not actually making fun of the topic. Okay, yeah, we are. But we have to, otherwise everybody gets all angry.
So Jim, tell us how that concession thing is supposed to work.
Well, it works differently in different departments. In other words, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service are in the Interior Department, along with the Bureau of Land Management. And they've got their own set of regulations for contracting to concessionaires and offering concessionaire contracts for bids. And the Forest Service is in the Department of Agriculture, and it'll be a little different over there. But essentially what you've got is a great deal of latitude on a part of the agencies that has increased dramatically since Clinton, with Bush not doing much one way or the other, and it now being under the Obama administration carried even further, of the time that the concessions are offered for and the renewal requirements for just me renewing you because you're doing such a good job and nobody else could do such a good job. And as the superintendent or manager or officer in the regional office, I certify to that effect and we renew you. And there's been a constant updating by computer of the concession contracts and the concession regulations that change two words, will and shall, to the word may. It's given the government more latitude and the concessionaire more latitude about what the concession really demands. And since there's no good IG oversight anymore, or any exposés, if you will, from the General Accountability Office, or audits, this has just simply gotten more and more amorphous, if you will, over the last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, just another example of what happens when you have no oversight and no consequence when the rules are bent or broken.
That's exactly right. Let me just mention something to you, too. When you think about audits, one of the fellows I talked to was working for a private contract outfit for the last few years. He told me that government contracts now for audits are all contracted out to private contractors. And you say, oh, gosh, they'll be really, really honest. And he said, he laughed. He said, no, he says, that's not the case at all. He said, the last one he was worked on, the contractor got the bid for doing 30 audits at one of the major departments in Washington. Now, it doesn't have to do with what we're talking about, but they had to audit certain kinds of programs. And they were going to do this for $3 million. And he said, up till about 8 or 10 years ago, he said, when you had a $3 million contract, as you did things, you charged to it, your hours, your travel, your this and your that, and you withdrew the money over time till it was done. He said, that's not the case anymore. He said, the company you work for drew down the entire $3 million in 2 weeks.
Well, they're busy.
Well, no, they just drew it down. And it was just shortly after that the government said that they didn't think they were going to be able to meet their contract requirements and fired them or let them go, but they get to keep the $3 million.
Oh,
now you
gosh.
Say, how can that be?
Yeah.
Well, because nobody's looking over them. But if I was the guy, the contractor, and you were the contracting officer in the government, you got orders to shut this down because it was they didn't want such and such exposed, and it looks like we were going to do that. And when I get to keep the $3 million, I give bonuses to my people and say, well, you guys go on home now. We're all done with this. Forget about it. You don't tell them what went on, but you keep the money then.
Yeah.
You're involved in it too. So you're not going to go out and say, Congress, I want to tell you what they're doing.
Sure.
Or you're not going to go to the newspaper and say, holy cow, you won't believe what's going on in such and such. But this kind of thing is going on all around the government.
Yeah, it is, because I found that in, back to the VA again, I found that there, they were calling it payout savings incentive. And so they got this PSI payment. And so a whistleblower that I had inside that office started doing a little homework. He goes, I don't know. We get these PSI payments. I don't even know what that is. Found out PSI stood for payout savings incentive. Well, they process veterans benefits claims. So they were getting paid to not grant benefits. It was kind of a backdoor incentive to deny claims.
Wow.
Although we were absolutely unable to prove it because
sure.
they had hidden their tracks really well. And as soon as we found out about it, it stopped and then became, I think they called it, it was like travel or something. It became some other category. And I bet that's happening everywhere.
Well, I think it is. When I was back in
there.
Washington, D.C. at the beginning of this month, and I was reading the Washington Post one morning, and there was an article in there about the national parks and the director of the national parks issuing an, quote, order, just like an executive order or order from the czar or supreme leader or whatever. But anyway, he issued an order that the national parks were going to be investigating selling a lot of rights for fundraising to corporations in the national parks where they could build things and put up logos and screens and interpretive programs from the corporations, and they could even design and construct buildings, and they maybe even operate it long-term because they've got an $11 billion backlog in maintenance. So the government is overcommitted to begin with, okay?
Yeah.
The government also is using this land. The agencies use it to get more money and get more people and get more power and influence for all the human reasons that we all do when given the opportunity to do that.
So they get more land, they get a bigger budget, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the budget needs to be spent on the maintenance that they got the money for in the first place.
In truth, the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, and Bureau of Land Management, four agencies I'm very, very familiar with, are just almost like your school system.
Uh-oh.
The schools need money because they've got poor children that need this, and they've got disabled children that need that, and they'll get all this money and they'll need more and whatever. But after 5 or 10 years, you go in and you look and you see that the money that was given to them and was still going for these things has all been eaten up in salaries.
Sure.
They've hired more people in the offices and promoted and given better retirement and blah, blah, blah. And this is not to knock teachers or anything. They're just as human as the rest of us. The same thing goes on with these parks. This business, oh, my gosh, we've got a backlog in maintenance. Oh, my gosh, we can't operate this anymore. We're going to have to close this down. I mean, we see this going on all around us all the time.
Well, we have a major park here in California near us that just raised their entrance fee to, I believe, $25 per car. And they say, well, you know, you can put as many people in that car as you want. It's only $25. Well,
but it's a day.
But that's a day. And you take a family of four, and they want to go to the park and hike around. They've got to pay $25 just to get in. That's a hit. And that's public ground that we're supposed to be able to go out and enjoy.
That we've already paid for.
We've already paid for. Yeah. And they need that money to maintain. Well, at $25, they won't have to maintain much because there's going to be a lot less people going out and enjoying it. But
exactly.
I'm curious, too, when you say maintenance, give us an idea of what that encompasses.
All right. You've got a national wildlife refuge with a headquarters, 20 dikes, and 30 miles of roads, and a farming operation that they rent out, but they may have to do some of it themselves. So they've got mowers and they've got some farming equipment and everything else. And they get money for maintenance each year, and they get money for operations. Now, the operations is your salary and my salary, and the fact that we have to drive over to the state capitol for a meeting, we spend operations money on that, and the fact that we have to work this weekend for doing law enforcement work because there's going to be a whole lot of people using the park or the refuge, you know, for whatever, we use operations money for that. And then maintenance money is the money that we have to spend periodically on the roads and on a sewage system and on mowing certain parts of the refuge and on taking care of the equipment that we have and things like that. So the thing is, the operations money never falters because our salaries are in that.
Right.
So that we always get that. But there's always, always, always periodic, oh, we can't give you the amount of money that you got last year for maintenance because of this, that, and the other thing, and you need to make your maintenance look like something else, and, you know, maybe we can get you
sure.
some of the other the different money, blah, blah. It's kind of like when the government has been buying land for the last 30 years, the federal government, they do not pay any state or local taxes on it. They do. They say, oh, that's no different. That's not really a problem because we'll pay you revenue sharing. You'll get that money, local governments and state governments, for schools and that. Even though our refuge or our park won't have a lot of people going to school, which is not true. They will. They will have employees there. But anyway, the state and local people say, oh, okay. But then each year, Congress has to appropriate that money. Well, things are really tough this year. We're in Iraq, or
yeah.
things are really tough this year. You know, we've got to get money over here to the Park Service for the big fire budget that they spent last year. Blah 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 blah. So the revenue sharing is just whatever they want it to be, as
sure.
is the maintenance money.
And that's a
and it's
that's
what
a
they
huge
decide
thing.
To give you because
well,
you're never going to get an accountability.
Sure, because I mean we have counties around us that are you know 70%. Public land, that's a huge grab.
Hey, oh, you bet. It's terrible. And it's behind why you've got such poor law enforcement at the local level anymore out in rural America. And this money for maintenance, when you look at your cities and your suburban counties, they've all got big, big problems all the time, unless they're real new, with the sewer pipes and with water pipes and with the road maintenance and that because maintenance, other than you and me bumping on when we drive our car down the road, we don't really care about that too much. We're not that worried that the mayor hasn't spent any money on maintaining the sewer lines for the last 8 years while he spent the money on building parks and baseball parks to get reelected. Maintenance is sort of the last thing you got to do, you know. But you have these periodic things like the Park Service now and the Washington Post article saying, oh, my gosh, $11 billion backlog in the maintenance on the national parks. And the refuges do that periodically. We did it when I was in the refuges division as their operations chief. That's what you do. And you come up with ideas for a name for it, and you come up with all these ideas like they mentioned in this article that was in the Washington Park Post about since our needs are so astronomic, we're going to be looking to corporations and asking them to develop things, and superintendents could maybe, quote, accept gifts of $100,000 up to $5 million. A superintendent.
Oh, my God.
A refuge manager can do that. But yet they're not allowed to solicit money, of course.
They've right.
Got, if you don't like it, well, I'll show you the solicit. Well, you can't solicit money. And if you do like it, you'll say, yeah, we're going to get, wink, wink, more of that kind of stuff in here. So you've got more and more of the federal government and these people that are favored by the federal government.
Public-private partnerships.
Exactly.
Which is always a problem. Hey, we've got to take one more quick break before the top of the hour. Hey, and I made a note to myself, but my other question for you, Jim, is with these endangered species, you know, the more listings they have, they need more people to go chase them around. Count them and fluff them and make sure no one touches them and all that. So that's another way they get more guys. Anyway, we'll be right back with Jim Beers. We're going to chat about more of this stuff, second hour as well. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Show you how your money's spent.
Oh, yes. Okay, why can't we be friends? Let's get those big corporations in there to cough out tons of money for the Parks Department, and let's just let them make those decisions at the local level. Won't that go well?
Yeah. You know, in a previous life, I used to work for a company that sold construction and maintenance equipment, and we bid. We were involved in quite a few bids with Park Service, and what we found was you could come in and totally meet the bid specs and come in low bidder and still not get the bid because of what you said earlier about putting, instead of shall, it says may. It leaves the door wide open for them to decide on what they want. And a lot of times what they told us was the operator makes the final decision. So regardless of cost, they get what they want, and they're dealing with taxpayer money. And I just, it used to infuriate me. In fact, we finally just quit bidding to the federal government because unless you're on the inside track, you weren't going to get it anyway.
Uh-oh. Jim?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
I thought you guys were talking to each other.
Sorry. No, we were talking to you.
Oh.
Yeah. It's kind of weird.
Exactly right. It's just an example of no oversight and local control and local decision-making isn't always the best thing.
Well, how's this? They've got one of the superintendents in a forest just to the south of us. There's a construction company. They've done lots of different projects, you know, building campgrounds and picnic benches and stuff like that. And this guy was like $600,000 below the next bid, and they didn't take him, even though he was qualified, met the bid specs and all that. But the guy that got the bid, the company that got the bid, one of the partners is a retired Forest Service employee.
Well, there you have it. You know,
what the heck?
You know, you need to put yourself, too, in the shoes of these superintendents and supervisors and managers and bureaucrats in Washington and regional offices with all of this loss of supervision, loss of accountability, and more of this flexibility for you to do whatever you want. When they tell superintendents that they could accept gifts of $100,000 to $5 million, yet they're not allowed to solicit money, that sends a real strong signal to you as a superintendent or a manager or a supervisor that, in fact, they want this done, and you're going to do everything you can to get gifts of higher and higher amounts because the more you get, the more you expect to be rewarded, either with the bonus for this year or a promotion next year, those kind of things. It's like we were talking earlier about the money from seizures associated with drug shipments and associated with an arrest, that they go to the government, and then the government can keep the stuff they want, auction off the stuff they don't want, and they get this big pile of money, and they're all happy because they can buy a prison down the road and please the president or whoever it is that they want to please politically. When that's the case, if you're one of the DEA agents, and I'm one of the DEA agents, and we're operating in the same area, we're probably going to be in competition not only between ourselves, you know, about, you know, I got $750,000 so far this month, or I've got, you know, $6 million this year, ha-ha, you know, that. We're going to be aware of the fact that our boss he's going to be rewarded for turning over more money to the Department of Justice. So if the one of us that gets the most money is going to be the one that probably gets rewarded the best. So that affects the way we do our job, whether we're a superintendent of one of these parks kissing up to some corporation, or we're a DEA agent and I say, hey, hold it. Let's just watch this. Wait. I want to make sure that they go into that house over there and don't let them get off of that boat, even though it might be a chance for them to get away. You're going to take risks and do things with that being your motivation.
Yeah, you're doing it for...
And that's not good.
No, you're doing it for all the wrong reasons. Jim, we have so much more to discuss. We have a five-minute coffee break here that involves some news, I believe. And we'll be right back with our guest, Jim Beers. You guys are going to love it. Find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.